Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Institute on Science for Global Policy's podcast, The Forum. I'm Cleo, and socializing with science today alongside me are my co-hosts Barbara and Aubrey. Today, we'll discuss the logistics of communicating climate change to both the public and policymakers. While the general facts about climate change are widely agreed upon across scientific communities, certain climate change details are not unanimously agreed upon and can still result in heated debate across many groups, and it's really important to figure out how in the world to communicate science when there's accompanying uncertainty around some of those details.
So today's episode will be another one in which you listen to us talk about the way scientists talk.
And it seems necessary that since we're talking about talking, you talk to us. Let's keep science communication afloat one tweet at a time. You'll find us at ISGP Forum, and you can use the hashtag ISGP Forum to make sure your voice is heard.
And if you're interested in this whole communication thing, be sure to check out episode 10, which covered the debate and position paper by Liz Neely on narrative persuasion within the sciences.
A very interesting topic indeed. Today's paper is from Mr. Keith Dixon, a research meteorologist for the Climate Impacts and Extremes Group at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton. Phew, that's quite a title. Also, shout out to Aubrey's current home.
Princeton labs are indeed my life these days.
Well, Mr. Dixon's paper was titled From Global Climate Perspectives to Regional Planning: Matching What Science Can Supply with Decision Maker Demands. And he defended it on February 20th through 21st in Tucson, Arizona, at the conference called Living with Less Water. This conference was part of our ICAP series, or ISGP's Climate Change Arctic Program.
And if you're paying close attention, you'll notice that that is acronym inception.
If you want to check out this paper for yourself, just go to www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org and click the Publications tab.
At its core, this paper argued that access to high-quality and understandable climate information is key if policymakers are going to make well-informed decisions on climate topics.
So, not only do we need better communicators, but we need to make sure that people have access to this better communicated information.
And don't be deceived by the simplicity of this idea. Science communication, especially in regards to a topic like climate change that has such a large scope, is no easy task.
Definitely not. So let's start by laying out what the issues are. Why do climate science and communication seem to be in a constant battle with one another? Well, first off, we can begin with the uncertainties associated with climate models, a subject which seemed to make up a great deal of this debate.
Uncertainties? I thought scientists were pretty darn sure climate change is real and that it poses a threat to society.
98% sure, actually, according to the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, report.
And take it from me. Getting 98% of scientists to agree on anything besides gravity is basically impossible.
This is all very true, but we're talking about a different kind of uncertainty here. This uncertainty originates from performing climate modeling, which utilizes experiments that can't be practically tested in the real world.
How do scientists perform climate modeling exactly?
Well, to put it simply, scientists can put past climate patterns and data into a computer, and then use a computer program to simulate how climate will change over time according to different variables. For instance, a variable might be atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations over time, or even melting polar ice caps. So climate modeling gives us a prediction for the future without offering us a way to test such predictions.
And if errors exist within these models, then over time we can observe lower accuracy and relevance of the results.
Which isn't good when you're trying to convince people your models are valid and that they should pay attention to them.
There are actually two different types of problems frequently observed in climate science.
Things aren't looking great so far for our climate modelers.
The story turns around eventually, I promise. But before that, these two prominent issues are 1, initial value problems, And two, boundary value problems. The former usually refers to the weather or short-term forecasts, while the latter deals more with climate or long-term forecasts over multiple years.
Errors in initial data are inevitable, but have a significant impact on the accuracy of short-term predictions. Factors that impact climate over the long run, like the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, then affect the process of predicting changes in the years to come.
And that is just the start of the uncertainty encountered in climate modeling. Natural occurrences, such as the Milankovitch cycles.
Hold up, what in the world are those?
The collective effects of changes in the Earth's movements due to climate.
Right, so things like these cycles can cause changes in atmospheric conditions.
Which, I'm guessing, isn't conducive to properly functioning climate models?
Exactly. It certainly causes uncertainty. Climate models focused on more local scales, which could be incredibly useful for at-risk communities, also suffer this same curse of uncertainty. Because the nature of these ambiguities is hard to convey to the public, many people are left skeptical of the predictions and recommendations that are based on these models,
making it particularly challenging for those trying to deliver climate science findings to the public.
And communication isn't the only issue here. There's concern that this uncertainty may cause public opposition to the use of federal funds to back climate science research.
Not to mention, there's always going to be that one person who will deny any validity of the climate information, not because of the science presented, but maybe because it threatens the financial interests of his or her organization, or perhaps violates deeply held beliefs.
And don't go thinking that policymakers themselves aren't to blame for this breakdown of communication. Recent spikes in the use of blanket statements like, "I am not a scientist," instead of responding properly to climate data, make it very difficult to have informed, productive conversations about public policy. Because of this common dismissal, the debaters suggested that science should be communicated in a way that makes it seem more relevant to policymakers.
All right, so what is being done currently to help in the translation of these problematic models?
Luckily, there exist boundary organizations that are tasked with helping to explain climate and science data. These include the U.S. Department of Interior's Regional Climate Science Centers, the multi-institutional South Central Climate Science Center, based at the University of Oklahoma at Norman, the Southwest Climate Science Center at the University of Arizona, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Climate Hubs.
Now, you'd think there would be a lot of coordination going on between these groups, but the unfortunate reality is that there is, in fact, little unification among them.
More interaction between these boundary organizations, multidisciplinary collaborations, and widespread education across all portions of the population are needed to more clearly determine and communicate these uncertainties that we've been talking about.
And in order to foster this process, the debaters categorize scientists into three general groups. Group one, those who have no interest interacting with the media and public.
Group two, those who do outreach and feel an obligation to do so.
And group three, those who are solely interested in advocacy and working in boundary organizations. However, there's a need for an in-between scientist, so to speak, one who has firsthand experience and knowledge of the political process. And that's the key, having a solid foundation in the policy sphere, as well as the science bubble.
If these in-between scientists existed, they could act as climate translators by conveying scientific data to the public while simultaneously expressing to scientists the public's need for information.
However, there happens to be a significant challenge in identifying translators who can serve as skilled intermediaries. Only a small number of scientists are actually willing to work this position.
This seems like a really important, maybe even vital, position to hold in terms of climate science, though. Why would no one want it? I mean, seriously, sign me up.
I can imagine it now. Aubrey, climate change translator extraordinaire, hired by all because of her mastery of science communication.
I keep having this image of another scientist whispering science jargon into your ear, and then you translating it for them for everyone else in the room.
Not exactly accurate, but I would still do it nonetheless. And my point still stands. Why would no one want to do that?
Well, this is in part due to the fact that translation work is relatively undervalued, and there aren't many incentives for performing such a task. Not to mention, the number of people who even have experience in this field is rather small.
But let's look on the bright side here.
True. I mean, things will get pretty darn bright with that ozone layer continuing to disappear.
No, I mean the optimistic side. This challenge creates an opportunity to develop training or even certification programs for non-scientists to become, quote, climate translators. And we could get the scientists involved in this too.
I thought we just established that doesn't work.
Well, policy could work to ensure incentives exist to do just that, make this work. The debaters actually thought offering incentives would be necessary to get more scientists involved.
And policies that encourage science translators would add value to their work, not to mention provide a larger pool of people to perform this highly important task.
The good news, too, is that certain extension efforts, such as the Pima County Cooperative Extension Program, can act as a model for imparting climate change info to citizens. However, some of these existing programs need to be beefed up with the addition of multidisciplinary teams.
Which is great, because there are a few more things standing in the way of people getting the right information.
What's new?
Yeah, well, you know those climate consulting groups that provide hard data about climate changes? Lately, they've been shifting from the public to the private sector, meaning there are now significant challenges for the dissemination of data on climate change.
Wait, how does the switch from public to private sector actually affect citizen knowledge?
Well, that data, now gathered by the private sector, is largely governed by non-disclosure agreements and is therefore not readily available to the people outside of those organizations.
It's a good thing we have tools like National Academy Reports, National Assessments, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC report, to condense public information into more comprehensible data for the rest of us. And there's always the media.
Yes, the media. But while they're an important source of information on climate science for the general public, actually, the media misconstrues a significant amount of the information distributed. This has largely been due to the decline of specialists working in the field.
But opportunities do exist to confront this inaccurate reporting. For instance, workers within the media need to be educated about climate science so that the information provided to them is then conveyed as clearly and accurately as possible to the readers, listeners, viewers, or whoever.
Who would take on a challenge like this, you may ask? Well, some of this work is actually already being done by Climate Central, an independent organization providing scientifically accurate climate change information to the media.
There are also opportunities and educational programs out there to train and teach both children and adults about climate science.
An example that expands upon these programs could be for scientists to work in partnerships with museums and other such groups that communicate with the public. This could create alliances that aid in dissemination and deciphering of climate data for non-scientific audiences.
What's great about boundary organizations like this is that they can serve as liaisons between scientists and stakeholders. Here we find an opportunity for individuals from all kinds of disciplines to work together and serve as these liaisons, rendering data into relevant information designed to answer the specific questions of specific audiences.
For instance, people who live near the Jersey Shore will probably care more about flooding than drought, so the information could be tailored to meet their needs and answer their specific questions.
And the debaters pointed this out as a particularly important detail. Before you can properly communicate to an audience, it's necessary to first determine their needs so that you can use that information as an opportunity to improve the exchange.
It's not only important for scientists to communicate with the public, though. This communication has to be bidirectional. A real conversation has to take place.
So I know we've driven this point into your heads today, but communication in the form of accurate information exchanges is essential for creating effective policies that will address climate change. And before we forget, we should also mention that the debaters thought the unique condition of the southwestern region of the United States merited its own conversation at the conference. This region actually experiences the effects of climate change before other areas of the country.
We can take advantage of this distinctiveness by creating adaptations that will be used as models elsewhere. In other words, the Southwest could be an example for other areas.
And while we're on the subject of making future plans, any sustainability plans put into motion must be incorporated into both daily and long-term government policy. At present, very few efforts or conversations are taking place about policy that incorporates current scientific data.
Which isn't ideal, considering we not only have to reduce future impacts, but we also have to help communities respond to the current effects of climate change.
Okay, but what about those funky climate models? Are we simply left to expect that they'll be forever inaccurate?
Well, the idea is that this won't always be the case, and that technology will continue to advance even more quickly than it already has. This being said, policies must aid in the development of this more accurate climate science technology.
Because without access to more useful data, answering those questions with societal relevance will remain one of our biggest challenges.
So now it's your turn to weigh in. If you fall into that category of general public, what do you expect out of your scientists in terms of communication? Do you want to hear the 411 directly from them? Where are your doubts? And where do you see the breakdown of communication?
Or perhaps you are a scientist. What would it take for you to become a climate translator?
$1 million? A letter of recognition from the President of the United States? Or just an understanding that your work would be for the greater good of society?
Wherever your opinion lies, tweet us at ISGPForum using hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to check out our Facebook page, ISGP's The Forum.
We here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy love to hear your feedback and opinions.
That's all we have for you this time, so go forth and bidirectionally communicate. We'll be doing the same.
Thanks so much for listening today and taking the time to socialize with science. We'll catch you right here next time on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.